It is Prospect Podcast time. A little bit of a different look. I'm Jacob Rudner, JJ Cooper here as always. Jeff Ponce, Josh Norris on the road doing their baseballing. And that is what roped me into this. But JJ, it's nice to join you. I'm looking forward to the conversation we're going to be having today. How are you?
Good. Thank you for stepping in. Because like you said, so we have this playoff baseball in the minor leagues. Hopefully, by the time you are watching or listening to this, Josh Norris will have seen David Shields versus Joey Oakey, which is about as spicy a Class A matchup, pitching matchup that you're going to get. And, oh, by the way, I would have to say, though, that he's getting second shrift on this because Jeff is seeing Erie versus Altoona. It's not often you get to see a playoff series where the number one prospect in the game faces off against the number two prospect in the game. We have Connor Griffin. We have Kevin McGonigal. Oh, yeah, by the way, we also throw in a Max Clark and a Josue Briseño and all as well. I'm jealous, but, you know, we'll stay here, you know, manning the fort and talking about prospects today.
Yeah, good opportunity to plug the website, though. Head on over to baseballamerica.com. Make sure you check out the content that's going to come from their various seeings of prospects. For us, though, JJ, we're going to talk about prospects of old, guys that we saw, or really you saw, in the past, who maybe Youngin. Didn't. Yeah, there you go. I mean, some of these guys I'm familiar with. I mean, they're not that old, but guys who maybe we didn't evaluate as well as we could have, who have outplayed what our projections were for them at the time. And I think the easiest way to break into this conversation is with Cal Raleigh, somebody who's caught fire, has caught, you know, the world by storm, whether you're a deep diehard baseball fan or somebody who's just into nicknames. He's been very popular. We had him as high as the Mariners' number 8 prospect in 2021, but that was as good as it got for him for our rankings. What went wrong? Not to say it's wrong, but where was the misstep in that?
Yeah. So that's what we want to do. We want to see if we can learn some things, learn some lessons from how we've ranked in the past. I would say with this, the criteria we used to pick these were players who are having excellent seasons at the big league level who never made a top 100, right? So you're going to see a lot of these where it says, you know, ranked in the top 10 in an organization, but we'll be the first to say, if we had to do over again, Cal Raleigh, who is in the MVP consideration, the discussion, should have been a top 100 prospect. So yes, he was a top 10 prospect in the Mariners, but not cracking the top 100 means, again, realistically, he should have been a top 50 prospect if we had it all to do over again. Hopefully, again, we're going to try to pull out some things here that maybe can be applicable down the road. And I would say with him, the concern that he always faced, there is a reason that he has the nickname he has, right? He's the big dumper. Well, the concerns were, how is his body going to age as a catcher, right? He's a bigger catcher. It wasn't something where it was like, oh, this guy's a brutal behind the plate or anything like that. He was actually rated as our best defensive catcher in the Mariners system when he was coming up. Now, best defensive catcher in some systems, you know, is one thing, and, you know, others, sometimes that's like you're an 8, sometimes that's you're a 45, depends on what the rest of the system looks like. But we also loved his bat, his power. He was a, we projected him to have 60 power at the time. Now, we'll get to that a little bit, that maybe that was light, but that's an aggressive grade, obviously. But what I would say is that what we've seen this year, I would say our grades were off by a grade or two. And so, we said 6 power, he's been 8 power this year. 8 power is, you know, I don't think we would even, I would have hard to have thrown an 8 on his power at the time, but it's 80 power. It's top of the scale power. We're talking about a catcher who's literally, you know, the best hit, having the best power season we've ever seen from an MLB catcher. But I would say the hit tool also, before this year, you know, Raleigh's a switch hitter, which has its challenges and its, you know, its benefits as well. So maybe because of that, it took a little bit longer for him to develop as far as his hit tool, because he's having to develop two swings. But we're all talking about now a guy who has generally been kind of a 220, 230 hitter with solid OBPs. becoming a 270 hitter, 270 plus hitter with excellent OBPs. Like that difference of 50 points plus that difference of 25 to 30 homers turning into 50 homers is the difference of someone going from being, again, someone who is a one of the best catchers in the game to one of the best players in the game. If I'm looking at it, if you ask me to kind of, okay, well, what is the lesson we should learn for this? Well, one is that, and this is one we still struggle with, and I want to kind of rope you in on this too, because you're part of this too. Evaluating catchers, I do believe, and I've talked to scouts who say, evaluating amateur catchers is probably the toughest part of their job. Because, well, for one, there is no position where the difference between the instruction you get as an amateur and as a pro is more significant, right? You're our college writer. The best programs, college programs in the country at developing catchers, working with catchers on their defense, are the 20-hour rule, right? Like there's only, you're playing games. There can't be that much instruction. You also have a limited number of coaches. You're trying to work around the margins as an amateur with your catching, with your receiving, right?
Well, I'll say this. I think one of the big things in the college ranks are teams are more trying to recruit guys who are ready to look like really good college catchers, not guys who they think can become really good catchers. Because to your point, the developmental timeline is really difficult, especially at a position that's so demanding. And so you're either getting it in raw talent for the most part, or you're not getting it at all. Like there are teams that will sacrifice behind the plate play in order to get a better bat because of what you're saying. It's not the landscape to be developing catchers at all. Cal Raleigh is the prime example.
So what I would say with that though is, so then you go from amateur baseball, you go to pro ball, and the day you arrive in pro ball as a catcher, you start to meet your team of people whose entire jobs, right? Like you literally have people in pro ball who their job is not to help you become a complete player as a catching prospect. There's other people to work on the other parts. Their job is just to make you a complete receiver. They're going to work with you on blocking. They're going to work with you on framing. They're going to work with you on throwing. They're going to work with you on every aspect of just catching. And so one thing I would say with that is that if you have a player, you hit on it. If you have a player who was catching in college, and again, Cal Raleigh was not a terrible defender in college either. Don't misunderstand me. But if you have a guy who's catching in college and he's a really good bat and he is terrible defensively, right? That guy in pro ball, if he has the aptitude, the athleticism, and the desire, there is a way that you can get someone like that. And I'm not saying that you're going to necessarily develop them into a gold glove catcher, you know, in the major leagues, although I think you could probably come up with examples of that. But I would say that you can absolutely get them to a point where you say, hey, that's a catcher who now is a very playable catcher at the minimum, and maybe better than that. Like to give an example of this, right? Using a current prospect that maybe, you know, if I'm trying to, Dominic Keegan's never going to hit 50 homers in a season. Don't misunderstand me here. But the Rays' Dominic Keegan was a guy who in college at Vanderbilt, every year it would start with Dominic Keegan's going to catch more this year. And every year, as the year went along, they would always have someone else who would end up catching, and Dominic Keegan would play a lot of first base because Dominic Keegan really can hit. But defensively, they never were comfortable with saying Dominic Keegan is our catcher. In pro ball, you have these games are for development. These games aren't just about getting to Omaha. They're about developing the long-term player. Dominic Keegan can be a full-time catcher, and he can move slowly. For a guy who had years at Vandy, he's been on a pretty slow track through the minor leagues. But you look at it and you say, and again, I still don't think he's a great catcher defensively, but he is vastly improved defensively over where he was when he was in college. So I do think that sometimes where we can struggle in our evaluations is these catchers whose bat was always there, but that who's defensively get better and better and better because you can get better in pro ball. You know, and again, Raleigh, I think, is probably about the extreme example of that. He's one that I look back on. And again, we should have 100% had him in the top 100. The season he's having, like, is something that I don't even know that, I mean, we couldn't have projected coming into this year. And he was a multi-year regular and a solid player before this year. I do struggle to say, like, oh, we should have caught, like, that. We should have seen 50 homers, you know, a 50-homer type season was coming.
Sure.
But we should have seen, you look at the production he had, you look at what he did in the minors, you look at the defensive reputation he had, the makeup, you know, all these things together, like, okay, yeah, oh, we'll take that as one that we missed on, not because we didn't know who he was. Obviously, there's none of these guys we didn't know who he was, but because we didn't, we probably undersold what we did. We undersold the bat, and especially the bat plus defensive improvement, steady, continual defensive improvement.
So, you know, this spurs this question for me. Is that a process flaw, or is that a byproduct of circumstances that you evaluated the player for who he was at the time? And it's not necessarily a miss as much as it is, this is somebody who grew over time into what he is now, and you couldn't really project for it. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. If I go back and look through our notes, I would say that we had really good notes from scouts who are like, this guy's, I think, going to be their everyday catcher for a long time. And again, our grade and all reflected the potential of that, but we probably, you know, he moved relatively quickly and it was a third round pick. And so I think we probably let our priors as a group kind of, here's an example of this, right? If you look at what he did in the minors and you compare Joey Bart and Cal Raleigh, who are, by the way, 100% contemporaries, right? I found notes from well before they were drafted where it's like, these are the guys of that catching class, right? If you look at Joey Bart as a pro and you look at Cal Raleigh as a pro, Cal Raleigh was always better. There was never a day that Joey Bart was better in pro ball than Cal Raleigh. However, this is where this gets challenging. So to answer your question, I'm kind of answering your question obliquely without meaning to, but Joey Bart was also the number two pick in the draft. And Cal Raleigh was a third round pick, pick 86, I believe. It's hard to completely flush that, right? Like, these players were evaluated for multiple years. Everyone bore down on them for the draft. And Joey Bart was at that time seen as a player who was on a different level than Cal Raleigh. And you look back on it and it's like, no, Cal Raleigh was on a different level than Joey Bart. And again, both of them are big league catchers. But if we could have flipped, I will put it this way. If we could have flipped those rankings in hindsight, we would have looked a lot better.
Ike Irish may be an example of somebody in a recent draft who could be worth.
We'll see if he wants to catch. Like, that's the want to is the key part there, right? Like, do you want to be a catcher? But Ike Irish is 100% example of a guy who, if he really can develop behind the plate, we really love the bat. Perfect example.
Kratz, I'm going to steal a line right from the top here about MeUndies. A cut for every butt. I took a line that I feel like you would enjoy, but then you stole my thunder with show and tell. What do you have there?
Besides a huge Baduka dunk, this is my pair of MeUndies that I got. I'm not going to show you the other pair right now because I got them on, but it doesn't even feel like you have them on. Super soft, flexible, and yet holding everything together.
I love the 20 different styles, 100 different colors and prints, and the micromodal fabric is what you're talking about. Breathable, stretchy, unbelievably cozy. And right now, as a listener of FT, you can get cozy and spooky for less with deals up to 50% off at MeUndies.com/Foul and enter promo code FOUL. That's MeUndies.com/Foul, promo code Foul for up to 50% off MeUndies. Comfort that's made for fall.
There you go. Let's move on. Michael Garcia, of the Royals. 5.4 B WAR. And I just want to emphasize B WAR for our colleagues who are listening to this and scoffing at the idea. But he's had a really good year, JJ. For us, as high as Royals number six prospect in 2023, a glove we loved, but maybe somebody who's developed into more of a well-rounded baseball player. What were the problems there?
Evaluating hit tools are hard, right? We really liked Michael Garcia. If you go back and read like our reports on Michael Garcia, we were like, basically, you know, we noted, you know, he's a cousin of, you know, of Ronald and Luis Angel Acuña, you know, okay, that's just background stuff. But we talked about like that he's a throwback type of hitter who uses the whole field, very good hand-eye coordination, solid barrel control, gap-to-gap power, above average hit tool, and he's better as a defender than he is as a hitter. So like you would read this report and you would say, they really like him, right? But we were really worried about the power. And if you're talking about someone who, okay, you can love the glove and you can, we projected him as a 55 hitter, but with 40 power and, you know, okay, 40, if he had been a 55 hitter, 40 power and on a team that didn't have Bobby Witt Jr. as a shortstop, that would have been probably a very solid player. Kind of knew he was going to be a third baseman. He was on the team with Bobby Witt Jr. And you're looking at that and saying, okay, is that going to be enough? Well, to his credit, exceptional defender at third base, which is what you would hope to have for a guy who really, you know, can 100% play shortstop, right? Like this is not a guy who, if Bobby Witt Jr. went down, perish the thought, as someone just loves baseball and good baseball players. But if Bobby Witt Jr. went down next year, you could say Michael Garcia defensively has the chops to just slide over there and play shortstop. Really good defender. But we didn't project that the power would be where it is. And I would say that he's now, we said 40 power. I would say that it's probably close to 50 power. So I think he's ended up being, and by the way, the bat to ball skills were better than we thought. We thought they were very good. But I would say that we had him as 55 hit with 40 power. And I would say that if you evaluated him now, you would say he's ended up being a 60 hitter with 50 power. And this is where... trust me, this is self-flagellation here. We're not doing this and saying we were right. It's actually, no, I'm just trying to lay out how difficult some of this is because the margins between if you're projecting a above average hitter to be a plus hitter, small. If you're projecting a 40 power guy to be, you know, he ends up being 50, you've missed it by one grade. But that is the difference. Like, let's take it the other way. If Michael Garcia's defense was every bit what we thought it was, but we were off on the hit tool the other way and the power the other way by one grade. If he was a 45 hitter with 30 power and we, or let's just say 50 hitter with 30 power, right? Because we're a half grade off on the hit and we're a full grade off on power. That would probably make him a utility infielder, you know, on most teams. I'm not saying there aren't teams where he would be potentially a second division regular, but there are a lot of teams where if you said, that's kind of like you're, then you're talking about like a Miguel Rojas type. And that's a guy who can start. But if you're starting Miguel Rojas over the years, you're probably wanting someone better. You're probably looking for someone better. So the margins here are, if you're off a little bit on the hit tool one way, and you're, then he's going to be less than you think. And if you're off one the other way, he's going to be much more than you think. This, I'd say the lessons that are taken from this are, you don't ever want to overrate the defense with a prospect because defense is, you know, you got to hit. But if you do hit and you have defense, then you, especially if you're an infielder, there are a lot of paths to being a very useful and productive player. The one aspect of this, though, that I would also say is a really difficult one is when Garcia came to the majors, he was bottom 20% in bat speed. To his credit, he is now kind of middle of the pack in bat speed. And that's been the difference in a guy who had below average power becoming a guy with average power. That's not a shock. Guys develop, you know, physically improve and work on weaknesses, which was a weakness of his. At the same time, again, that's one of the challenges of this. It does go back to an old scouting axiom, though, that like, and if you rely on this too much, I think you will be burned. But if you don't rely on it enough, you'll be burned also, which is when you have guys who are great defenders, right, who have the hand eye to be an elite defender, at especially at shortstop. It's hard to imagine that at some point as they gain strength, that hand-eye coordination won't have some relation to their hitting ability. Now, if they swing at everything as soon as the pitcher goes in into his motion or things like that, it can kind of get in the way. But you know, we do see examples of this, right? We do see examples of guys who arrive in the majors as kind of like 20 or 30 bat shortstops, but they're so good defensively that they stick around for years. And by the end of it, they're actually like, you know, two grades higher as a hitter, because what happens is they just get that time. They have that time to develop as a hitter because the other skills are so good, and they have the hand eye that eventually it all catches up. So we got it wrong with Miguel Garcia. You know, he was a top 250 prospect, I would say, for us, but he should have been a top 100.
Is there a lesson in there that defense should count for more? What do you take away from this?
See, this is where this gets tough, right? Because defense is very important. However, you can also go overboard on it, right? Because it's that combo pack, right? It's having defense combined with enough hitting ability. Because to take the extreme example of it, if you said, okay, he's a 20 hitter and he's an 80 defender, those guys don't play in the big leagues. Those guys really are, I wouldn't say they're a dime a dozen, but they're really not guys that you turn around to and say, yeah, that worked out for them. But if you are a 40 hitter with 70-80 defense, I think that can work out for you. You know, and then I would say also on top of that, if you're right on the defense and just off a little bit on the offense, then they could end up developing even further than that, right? So the tough part of this is I'm trying to think of an example of a shortstop like this, because there are definitely like center fielders I can think of where we've been burned because really we believed in the defense. And then you look on it and you say, okay, yeah, the defense is good, but it's just not enough by itself. But then there are shortstops who, you know, Ray Ordonez is a really bad hitter, but he had a very long career because the defense was so good. So I would say, yes, the defense needs to be and absolutely plays a big role in this. But I would also say, like, Michael Garcia ended up, we didn't project on his move to third, but he ended up being a 7 defender at third. And there's a big difference between a 7 defender and a 6. Matt Chapman, when he was coming up, had hit tool questions, always had power. But if you're a 7 or an 8 at third base, then that really does. Now, you know, again, but at the same time, there are also guys like, you know, Sal Stewart is an instructive one right now. Like, if you're evaluating Sal Stewart right now at third base, I don't think he's going to be able to stay there long-term. I think that they're going to want more defensively. If you evaluate him as a first baseman, okay, well then that's a different evaluation. This is, I mean, again, the thing about it is this is why I love doing this. I've been doing this at Baseball America for over 20 years. You'll never master it. You can keep getting closer. You can try to keep getting better, but the best way I can explain it to people is I'll try this way. Major league teams with hundreds of people working in their front offices get it wrong on free agents who have 6 or 7 year MLB track records, right? And they get it wrong every year. And the flip side is we also have guys who are minor league invites to spring training every year who pop. There is a variability to this game that is maddening, but also fascinating at the same time, is the way I would put it.
I think that's the perfect transition to talk about how pitching is impacted by some of these decisions. Christopher Sanchez is the example that we're going to talk about. He was the Phillies' number 17 prospect in 2020, which, by the way, I am going to ask for you to discuss how maybe 2020 impacted some of the ways that Baseball America was doing things and gathering information, and whether or not that could have been a factor in maybe missing a little bit on Christopher Sanchez. But more importantly, big league development and how that impacts players sometimes that we really can't account for, and how Christopher Sanchez might be a great example of that. Hiring the right people fast keeps your team moving forward without losing momentum. Every day a position stays open is a day you're missing productivity, creativity, and growth. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One thing I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it allows you to rapidly sort through candidates based on your preferences. Plus, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica. Just go to Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need.
Okay, so let's start with congratulations, Philadelphia Phillies. For the longest time, it looked like that, this is a trade that the Rays had won, because look at Curtis Meade for Christopher Sanchez. No, the Phillies won this trade, right? At this point, Curtis Meade, by the way, being an instructive example of, never did believe in the defense of him at third or second, and probably never downgraded enough on that. Like, that he couldn't really throw. He really can't throw. And so that limits him to first base. First base is a very difficult position to, you better really mash. Hey, I'm not saying it's all over for him. Look at Jonathan Aranda, you know, again, another Rays prospect who is now mashing. But Christopher Sanchez was a guy who, I would say, we'll get into the 2020 component of this, but I would also say with Christopher Sanchez that the other challenge was, the reason he was traded from the Rays to the Phillies was, is that he had to be put on the 40 man when he was still quite far from being big league ready, right? And so because of that, if you map that out, it really seemed to be sending him down the road to be a left-handed power or left-handed reliever, right? Because you had a guy who was going to have to, he was on the 40 man, he signed internationally, I think 3 years in the DSL, you throw in the pandemic. So he was being added to the 40 man at a time where he didn't have any upper level minor league experience. You're going to start running out of options before long. You don't want to carry a guy, a pitcher on your 40 man roster for multiple years without getting something out of him. And so he did. He made his big league debut as a left-handed reliever with control trouble. And normally, if you have a guy who's coming up as a left-handed reliever with control issues, who's not throwing, by the way, 100 miles an hour either, you don't project that guy to make the steps forward to become a front-of-the-rotation starter. And that's what Sanchez has done, to his and the Phillies' credit. Like, I think the instructive lesson here, which is one that is very hard to reflect in prospect rankings, is player development at the big league level is very important, right? It doesn't stop when you hit the big leagues. To take an example the other way, look at a couple of guys, you know, I'm just thinking of a couple examples from one team. I'm sure I could find this for multiple teams, right? But I remember a couple of years ago, we had Eddie Julian at the back of the top 100. And Edouard Julian played at Auburn, Twins, gets to the big leagues, and has a productive rookie year. I believe he was over 2 WAR as a rookie. You know, kind of was what we were talking about, right? That we were looking at poor defensive second baseman slash first baseman, but who hit enough to make that work. And then it's really, he's never been that again, you know, like, and so maybe that's a Julian thing, but maybe that's a player development at the major league level thing where it's like, okay, as your weaknesses get exposed, are you able to make adjustments? To Christopher Sanchez's credit, when he arrived in the majors, not as a fully finished product, obviously, we just said he had to be rushed because the 40-man roster, all that. But when he arrived, he was a 93-mile-an-hour lefty reliever with control troubles. He is now a 95-mile-an-hour lefty starter who throws strikes. Now, I would say that in hindsight, we were probably underrating the changeup a little bit. It was better than we thought. That's something that we could take from this. I also will say, if you told me, and I know a lot of pitchers continue to develop velocity, but if you had told me that the 93-mile-an-hour reliever would become the 95-mile-an-hour starter, that would be difficult for me to feel comfortable that we could project when he was making his pro debut, big league debut, I should say. But that's a credit to him and the Phillies. That's like one of those massive wins to me is, and the Phillies have done this a couple of times. I would say that there is no one in the world, like you could include him in here as well. Like Ranger Suarez is better than anyone other than Ranger Suarez and Ranger Suarez's immediate family probably ever believed that he would be. And so when you do that, when you have wins like that, it really does make a difference for a big league club.
Is Gavin Lux an example of a player who maybe didn't have ideal big league development and kind of stagnated?
Potentially. I would say with Lux, a couple of things. One, I think that defensively, I mean, for one, and again, I don't want to take a cop out. He had a significant wrist injury, right? So one thing you never know with something like that is was that a setback or was that something where wrists are very important to hitting? So like, is that something where after that, it never was the same? But I would also say defensively, instead of getting better at the big league level, it just kept regressing at the big league level, right? You're talking about a guy who arrived in the majors and you're like, he's probably not a shortstop, but he should be a good second baseman. And I would say defensively, he's been a little disappointing that way. We are talking about someone who hasn't had the impact that we thought he would. No, that's 100% true.
Let's go back to pitching here. Logan Webb, number 6 on the Giants, top 30 in 2019. One of the best strike throwers, some outstanding stuff in the big leagues right now. Cy Young contender in the National League. Where did you miss there?
So I would say, one is we didn't touch on it with Sanchez, but it's a good one to touch on here, which is 2020 did make things difficult, right? Because there essentially was this period of time where you didn't get, we got as much info as we could, but there just wasn't as much information out there. You know, you alt sites were not the same as minor league games, right? So you did have players. I think Michael Harris, I've always used an example of a player who, like, you know, I had some Braves fan who said we completely, you know, whiffed on Michael Harris. It's like, we had him in the top 100 pretty high. You know, he's like, yeah, but he didn't do it fast enough. It's like, we didn't have him after 2019 when he was a fourth round pick who didn't hit that much. And then we didn't rank him in 2020 because there were no games, but then we did have 21. I felt like we reacted pretty well on him. In Webb's case, though, I would say, okay, couple things. One, he's a sinker baller, right? And I would say that if you said what is a truly, and especially he was a sinker baller coming up in the era of the four-seam fastball, right? He was perfectly positioned, perfectly timed in that at just the moment where all of a sudden umpires started inspecting gloves and saying like, wait, why is your hand stuck to that ball? And well, you know, you could hold it like that for four seam, you know, fastball throwers who are getting a little extra ride at the top of the zone. That's not a problem for Logan Webb because Logan Webb is sinkers, sliders, changeups. So we've, you know, I can't help but think back to Brandon Webb, who unfortunately, like if you're younger than me, you might be like Brandon Webb, but Brandon Webb was a stud for the Diamondbacks for a stretch of time. And then he had injuries and it kind of ended pretty quickly, but he was a stud. And it's kind of that same thing of like, you know, I've now gone through two generations of this, of like, what did we miss with the sinker baller? The part that's, so I would say that we probably undersold his changeup. Again, in hindsight, changeups are hard. He did have a PED suspension. It's hard not to be colored by that a little bit, to have a little bit of concern. You know, it was an 80-game suspension, you know, for, you know, that he faced before he went to the big league. So, like, that was probably in the mind. Control and command are definitely better than we thought. Those are things that we could have seen, I think. The one that you can't predict that has been important and vital, I think, to the Logan Webb experience is he's the most durable pitcher in baseball, right? Like, he's about to probably lead his league in innings pitched for a third straight season. That's a level of durability that you just don't. I don't know how you project that, right? Like, I don't, like, he was athletic. He was a football player in high school. There's things you could maybe use as markers. You could like his delivery and all that. But then to say, this guy's going to give you 200 plus innings every single year, that's the part that's more, you know, more difficult to project. But I do think, again, in his case, like if we had it to do over again, it would be like, hey, we're probably, you know, sinker slider guys like this, they're not going to have some of the same markers, right? Like, you've got to look a little differently on them as far as what stands out. It's not the same thing as if you're talking about a four seam fastball guy. Just to give an example of it, right? Logan Webb has ended up being much better than Dustin May, but both of them are kind of, Dustin May was for a period of time kind of like the highlight clip pitcher because he gets such extreme arm side run on his fastball. That by itself wasn't as productive as it looked, right? It looked great, but it was generally not generating a whole lot of ground balls. It wasn't generating a whole ton of swings and misses. Logan Webb may not have looked as impressive, but he was doing all those things. He was getting those things and doing it while being extremely durable. If we had it do over again, like, again, that's probably the thing. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, the next time we see like a really good sinker, you know, paired with a slider, paired with a boarded bat on the changeup. And again, and expecting that control and command, one of the things that also does happen with these pitchers is, like, as you get older, hopefully you start to more understand how that pitch moves on you. That, you know, to take an example that we've talked, you know, that's been talked a lot over the years, right? It's one thing, having seam shifted wake can be really useful for a pitcher. If you know what you're doing with it, it can make the pitch moves in ways that hitters don't expect. If you don't know what you're doing with it, seam shifted weight can be like, why did my pitch move like that this time and not next time and not the time after that, right? There is intentional seam shifted weight, which is kind of how the seams basically interact with airflow and make the ball move. And then there's unintentional, where it's like it moved this time, but it doesn't move next time. And then there's intentional, I would say, where you know what you're doing, you grip it this way, you throw it this way, and it does it time and time again. That's something where there's a challenge of, okay, does this, you know, sometimes someone who doesn't know what they're doing with it as a 21-year-old will often figure that out by 24, 25.
Let me ask you a question for the people listening to this who want to get a better look into how the sausage is made when it comes to evaluating prospects. How have you utilized some of the things that we've talked about over the course of the last 40 minutes to alter your process? Where have you felt the biggest change over, let's say, a 5-year period since 2020? Where have you felt the biggest change in your evaluation of hitters and pitchers?
Okay, great question. One thing I would say is, I mean, we have more info now. We always want to have more info than we did before, right? And we definitely have more info now than we did 5 years ago. There are things that I would say that there are things like that you always are trying to learn more. If you said one thing 5 years ago to now is understanding how pitching arsenals all play together, right? Like, okay, this may seem like a great fastball or a great changeup, but like this other pitcher, fastball, slider, changeup seem to work together better, and understanding that. So that'd be one. And understanding, I would say part of it is like, okay, allowing for what development could mean. And again, the one thing with all of this is we get it. People look at the rankings a lot, right? One thing that does stand out about this, though, that again, we always talk about is we really, like, one of the things we want to do, we don't just rank them, we write full reports on these players. And a lot of times, we talk about this all the time, you know, internally. Take Spencer Jones right now, right? Like, Yankees prospect. Wherever you rank Spencer Jones right now, you have a very high likelihood. Well, let's put it this way. If you want to rank Spencer Jones as the 500 or 650 best prospect in the game, feel free. And you very well may be right, right? You could absolutely say his strikeout rate meant that he never had a productive big league career. And hey, look, you were right. And that very well may be right. But you have to understand, this isn't light switches. This isn't yes, no. This isn't on, off. This isn't, you know, code 0 or 1. These are probabilities. And in Spencer Jones' case right now, as we're getting ready to head into the offseason, I would say that if I was ranking out probabilities, I would say there's a 50% chance that Spencer Jones never has a productive season as a big league regular. I'd say 50%, right? You could, if you wanted to argue 60, if you wanted to argue 40, feel free. I would say that there is a 20 to 30% chance that Spencer Jones has a season where you're like, oh, Spencer Jones had a productive year because his power really played, but it was sandwiched around 2 years where the power didn't play because he hit for such low average, struck out so much that it derailed him, right? And if you said, give me examples of that, Aristides Aquino, who had one season where he hit 19 homers in 58 games, was a 2-WAR player, and that's the only season he did that. Or to take a modern example, right? Joe Adell. Like, what's the evaluation of Joe Adell right now? Like, do we overrank him or underrank him in the top 100? Because Joe Adell has had kind of an up and down career, but at the same time, he's also, you know, really good as a power hitter this year. Defensively limited, asked to do things probably beyond his abilities. That's not really his fault, but that's another example, right? So you're trying to lay out probabilities here. You're trying to lay out, hopefully, in a report, in the scouting report that we write, here's what we're hearing, here's what we're seeing as far as the potential outcomes for this player. We talked about it, you know, like we said right there, like we talked about with, you know, with Michael Garcia, his report, right? When you talk about Cal Raleigh's report, or you talk about Christopher Sanchez's report, or you talk about Logan Webb's report, like Logan Webb's report, the Giants have tremendous faith in Webb, who they believe is one of the best athletes in the system. The right-hander starts his arsenal with a low to mid fastball that has touched as high as 98, low to mid 90s fastball, touched as high as 98, but he must refine the command of his fastball. He gets tremendous lateral movement, which Webb hasn't learned how to consistently harness. He backs the fastball with low 80 slider and mid 80s changeup. He uses a near equal measure. He worked in 2019 to make his arm slot more consistent on all his pitches. Once he'd done that, he quickly moved through the system, right? That's laying out, hey, it's one of the best athletes in the system. This is the guy who has some of the best movement on his fastball of anyone they have. So you have kind of the, if he can do this, he could be really good. Again, where we got it wrong in hindsight is he did that. Maybe we undersold the likelihood he would do that. But I do hope, like, when I don't get as frustrated to say when things we learn, if the report lays out this player has this problem, if he can fix this problem, he could be really good. I have a lot less problem with that player end up being really good. And it's like, oh, well, we missed on that one. He should have ranked higher. Okay, we should have. But I have much less problem with that one than if you read a report on a big leaguer and you're reading that report and you say, this has nothing like the player ended up being in the big leagues. That I have much more of a problem, even if we got the ranking right, if that makes sense, right? Because you're trying to project what the player is going to look like. And sometimes a player has a minor flaw that ends up derailing them. And sometimes they have a major flaw that they end up solving. And both of those can happen. You do want to, though, hopefully provide the information to the reader, to the person who's the Baseball America subscriber, to the prospect handbook purchaser. So then you, as you read it, can make your decision, can make your evaluation on, oh, I believe he can fix that. Okay, then maybe you want to rank that player higher than we did. Or you say, you know, and but this is something where the best we can do, like if we're doing this right, like we just did our DSL top 35 recently, right? And I get it. We have some Mets fans who are not real thrilled with where we ranked Eli and Pena. That's fine. Just understand we ranked him there because we talked to, I think Josh talked to five different scouts who saw Eli and Pena in the DSL. And the consistent reports were mature body, not really a whole lot of, or I don't know if there's a plus tool here. Good hitter. I don't know if he's going to be a great hitter, but good hitter. Don't know if he's going to be a good defender. We're trying to reflect that. We're trying to relay that. And that doesn't mean, like, if you read the report that we wrote about Eli and Pena in the DSL, it didn't say this guy's a bust, this guy's a bum, this guy's not going to be anything. It was, this guy could be good, but here are the concerns, and here's what could keep him from being great. And then there are other players in the DSL that the write-up, if you read the write-up, it's like, this guy's not even very good right now. This guy has to fix this, and he has to fix this, and he has to fix this, and he has to fix this. However, he also could be great because of this. You, the reader, can then say, okay, I have this information. You know, I can take a chance on Kilfredi Encarnacion, who is more volatile and riskier, I would say, at this point than, you know, juggling dynamite. But at the same time, if it all comes together, watch out. Or you could say, I don't want to deal with someone that risky. I want to take the Eli and Peñas where it's like, this guy finished really strong. Okay, and maybe he's going to be a solid player, but I want that. And I think there's a higher likelihood of that turning out than the player who, you know, hasn't thrown many innings, has a lot of things they have to fix.
So does this make you more risk tolerant? Does the degree of risk tolerance increase with all of this being said, and has it increased over the years? Because it seems to me, at least from our conversation, that you may be better off trying to be more aggressive in both your projections and your ranking of somebody who you think has a chance to be really good, as opposed to catering to potentially what they are or more underdeveloped areas of their game. You don't always have to be safe is seemingly one of the takeaways here.
I would say yes to an extent, right? Like if you want to try to nail the late developing AAA MILB vet, I don't think that that's a very fallow. I don't think that's a very fertile ground to you know, to fish in, right? Like, and you're, every now and then you're going to hit the guy who has that 1 year in the big leagues and then kind of flames out again, right? Like if you're saying like, I'm going to look at the best performing 25, 26 year olds in the major leagues and you say, that's where I'm going to focus. I don't know if that's where you really want to aim, right? At the same time, also understand if you say, I'm only going to be interested in 19-year-olds in rookie ball or 17-year-olds in rookie ball, you're also going to have more misses than hits. So you've got to blend it all, right? Like, and that's where, again, if you say, what are we trying to do here, right? Two guys who I'd say, like, I'm very happy with. We'll end this on a positive note, this segment, right? Thankfully, most of the players who have been very productive this year did rank in the top 100. Thankfully, most of them ranked pretty high in the top 100. So thankfully, we do have misses, but thankfully, the majority of players, you say, the vast majority of players who are best players in the big leagues are top 100 prospects. That's it. You know, that's just true. I would say with this, like if you look at this year, and we don't know yet, right? We don't know if Connor Griffin is going to be a long-term success story. We don't know if Kevin McGonigal is going to be a long-term success story. We don't know if Jesus Mate, those are our top prospects in the game now. But I will say with all of them, they already are successes in some form from the standpoint of if the Pirates today wanted to trade Punter Griffin, and I don't know why they would, and I don't think they will. But if they did, they could get a king's ransom for Connor Griffin. They could get so much more than they could the day after they drafted him. And yes, I understand you can't trade drafted players for 6 months after they're drafted until after the season and all that. Please, you can leave that comment if you want on YouTube, but I am aware. But like I'm saying, but if you look at where Connor Griffin was valued at the time of the draft to where he is now, he is massively further along. If you look at where Jesus Mate, who, by the way, was valued by teams when he was in the DSL, but where he is valued now, way, way more. So those things are already success stories. But we don't know if they're going to pay off as big leaguers. However, those are synthesizing of trying to do all we do, right? We got really good reports. Josh Norris, for us, went down the DSL last year. And everyone down there was raving that Jesus Mate was a player you had to see, right? And then we got data. And remember Jeff Ponce on one of these podcasts talking about, he said, you don't see plate discipline numbers like this from a DSL hitter like you're seeing from Mate. You're seeing the plate discipline of a 25-year-old MLB vet who's really good at it, doing that against pitchers who, you know, are all over the zone from pitch to pitch. And so you marry, and then you talk to scouts who are like, the tools for him are really good. All these things together, and you try to put all that together and say, okay, that's why we're going to be really aggressive with a Jesus Mate. That's why, you know, there were questions about Connor Griffin's hit tool in the coming into the draft, but the athleticism, the tools were exceptional. So in his case, it was like, okay, we understand there's a lot of risk here, but these aspects make him still a top 100 prospect, even with that risk. And then I remember us, you know, you can check it out on YouTube. We did it, you know, we did videos on it in spring training. We're like, hey, his swing's better now. We looked at it. Now we've seen it. We've talked to people, you know, scouts and all. This guy's got a better swing now than he did in high school. And then you saw him take off. The flip side of that is Kevin McGonigal, who no one ever had a question about Kevin McGonigal's hitting ability. But I want to give Ben Badler credit on this one. Ben saw him for years, you know, as an amateur and always loved him. And with McGonigal, it was like, no, he's a better athlete than you think, right? Not going to say he's going to be a seven defender at short, but this guy can really hit. This power is going to develop. And he is a middle infielder, you know. And by the way, I get now grades like, okay, might be a six or a seven at second down the road. Maybe that's what he ends up being. Probably the best defensive second baseman that the Tigers have had a long time, because they've had a lot of pretty fringy second baseman defensively. But that's where you try to put all this together and then be aggressive. But again, you want to be, okay, I'll go all Admiral Nimitz, you know, and World War II here. It's called calculated risk, right? So you're not just taking giant wild swings. You're trying to marry all this together and fit the pieces together to try as best you can to line it up. And this is where we learn from this, right? So when you say about the risk and all that, what you're really trying to do is figure out, like, yeah, you really are trying to figure out who are going to be above average regulars long term, right? I'm not saying we're not trying to, in our handbook, we want to write up everyone who is a productive regular of any sort and some contributing players and all that. But I'm not going to beat myself up. I'm not going to beat you up. You know, like if you write, turn in a Marlins chapter and you miss on a guy who got 50 unproductive at bats in the big leagues 3 years from now, and you say you didn't have that big leaguer on it, that's not where I'm not feeling bad about that. Now, at the same time, you know, we do, even if it ends up being in a different organization, we don't want to miss on when, you know, when Xavier Edwards, right, who's ended up being a very productive player for the Marlins, we wrote him up for Padres, we wrote him up for the Rays, and we always just said, this guy can really hit. Questions about his defense, there are other questions, but the guy can really hit. That's where you want, it's like, okay, this guy has a tool that can make him a productive big league regular long term.
Last thing I want to talk about with you before we jump on our prospect soapboxes here. Is there a common thread, JJ, between the people who we end up quote unquote missing on as we have this discussion. We talked about Logan Webb and Christopher Sanchez and Michael Garcia. Is there something that they share in common that led to them all being included in this conversation?
I don't know about if there's a common thread things. Those four, I would say the one that we still are working on as best we can. We talked about it at the start of this with Cal Raleigh, that catching's really hard. Evaluating catching is really hard. I want to get better at that, right? I want us to keep getting better at that. We're trying. We were talking about the Marlins, right? Like the Marlins have like seven catching prospects. So I feel like on Augustin Ramirez, we've gotten that one so far nailed pretty well, which was this guy can hit. We don't think defensively, like the reports we have are that defensively it's not going to work out necessarily. Joe Mack, I think is kind of a more well-rounded, but we'll see what Joe Mack ends up being, for example. I would say though that also, like you look at Rule 5 pick Liam Hicks, I would say that I've been surprised by how useful Liam Hicks has been this year. And I've liked Liam Hicks for a number of years, but these are, again, I would say catching is really hard because to take the extreme example of it, Patrick Bailey's really good, but Patrick Bailey's value is something that I don't know if we had perfect hindsight, would you be able to say, okay, we really like Patrick Bailey's glove, but he's going to be the best framer in the big leagues by such a large margin that it will make him one of the better catchers in the big leagues. That's harder to even now today to project on than it is to say that JT Realmuto a few years ago is like, this is a really good athlete who can also catch, right? It was a strong arm. It's easier to hit on the JT Realmutos of the world as a valuation than it is the Patrick Baileys is the way I would put it.
All right, JJ. It is prospect soapbox time. We've had plenty of time to think about this. Who are you going to stand for today?
Okay. I'm going to go with, I was talking about this guy in the chat today that we, as we record this, I did the chat on Tuesday at baseballamerica.com. We try to chat most weeks. So check it out if you didn't, but someone asked, he said, who's the Braves prospect most likely to pop? And I will tell you, as someone who's done Braves list, well, someone who's covered the Braves, let me put it this way, going back into the 90s, right? It feels like that going back to, I got to see Jermaine Dye play in the outfield in the Braves minor leagues. I got to see Andrew Jones. I got to see, it felt like that the Braves just had this never ending run. Ronald Acuna obviously stands out. Over the years of this never-ending run of outfield prospects. After Michael Harris, that pretty much dried up for a while there, right? Like I would say that you could look around and say for a couple of years there, who's the next great Braves outfield prospect? And you could say, I don't think there is one. I am not going to tell you that Diego Torres is that. I will say that there's at least a chance he could be. Again, I want to give credit to Josh Norris. He's the one who went down the DSL. He's the one who talked to a ton of scouts who evaluate players in DSL. He's the one who did our top 35 DSL prospects. But if you look at the notes we have on Torres, it does stand out that this is a guy who far, far, far away. You asked the question about balancing risk versus reward. This is all kind of risk with all kind of potential reward, but we'll see how much reward you get. But I will say, if you look at it, you can say, if it all pans out, this guy could be a very solid, a very productive big league regular, which is, again, that's better than any Braves outfield prospect that we can talk about for a good number of years now. What about for you?
I'm going to talk pitching. I'm glad that we're going to have one of each here. And for me, it's Carson Milbrandt of the Marlins system. First of all, Carson Milbrandt is finally in AA. He made two AA starts and looked really good doing them. One of the biggest things about him going into the season, and one of the reasons why he is towards the bottom of our Marlins top 30, is because his timeline of progression has been reasonably slow. So first of all, 21-year-old Carson is now in AA. However, the biggest thing for me is that he has redesigned himself and his pitch mix. He's 20 pounds heavier than he was in 2024, according to a couple sources with the Marlins. That has helped him throw better strikes and to maintain his technique a little bit better. He's stronger. He didn't play as much baseball in the offseason as he had in the past, and focusing on strength and conditioning has helped him. The other change that's been really beneficial for Carson Milbrandt, and one of the reasons why, as the Marlins guy, I can forecast some significant upwards movement in our next ranking of the Marlins top 30, is he's throwing pitches differently. He's using his slider more often, about 30% of the time, and he's throwing that tight curveball a lot more as well. Both pitches have been really good at generating swings and misses. The Marlins are super high on this guy. He's going to play in the AFL this fall, has a 3 ERA in 90 innings with, I believe, 113 total strikeouts. The control is still a problem, JJ, but this seems like a pitcher on the rise in an organization that, as will appear on baseballamerica.com in the coming days, has done a really good job of kind of changing things up in its development and making players look a lot better than they have in recent years.
I think you hit on a key point there when we talk about development, right? We often talk about players developing, getting stronger physically, and how that can increase their velocity. You hit on another key part, though, here, which is getting stronger also can be often the difference of throwing more strikes, because I see this a lot. Like, I used to really get worried when I saw head whacks among amateur pitchers. And if you're wondering what a head whack is, think of it as like, you know, sometimes they're facing down as they're at release point because they're almost using their head to help pull their arm through. And I've come to realize, I'm not saying you don't see that in pro ball, but you don't see it nearly as often in pro ball. And why is that? It's because the guys who are doing that as 16, 17-year-olds, usually it's because their bodies aren't strong enough to do everything the way they should do it yet. And often, whether it's through weight room work or just natural maturation, or often both, and eating well, doing all these things, right? It can be the thing where that goes away, because all of a sudden, as they just get into their low early 20s, you know, and all, they fill out, they mature. And then all of a sudden, the things that were hard for them to do pitch after pitch become much easier because they're stronger. And I do think, like, that's a good point you made with Milbrandt, is his control's gotten better partly because he's stronger. It's not just like, we can talk about refining deliveries and all that. Sometimes I feel like that delivery refinement or repeating release points and all this comes down to, I'm now strong enough to do it, whereas before I wasn't.
There you go. You heard it here on the Prospect Podcast. That's going to do it for this episode of the Prospect Podcast. Before we let you go, though, we do want to encourage you, head on over to baseballamerica.com to check out what we're all writing. There's lots of content going up on the site, even if it's slow season for some parts of the baseball world. Also, head on over to YouTube, Baseball America YouTube channel, constantly pumping out content over there. For JJ Cooper, though, I'm Jacob Rudner, and we will see you next time.